Hey there, and welcome to Entree Podcasting with ZFS. This is my new networking adventure where I get to introduce you to some of my fellow entrepreneurs, success stories, and downright inspiring people. I am your host, Zach Stafford, and it's now time to get plugged in and on the line. Today's guest is a 17-year entrepreneur, a former sporting event referee, umpire, and professional voice actor. He's been featured by Texas Monthly as a recognized five-star wealth manager. And speaking of magazines, he's the 2006 Time Magazine Person of the Year. It's now time to get plugged in with financial advisor Paul Emick.
Hey, Zach. What's good to chat with you, man.
Likewise. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I got to start off with a little piece of information that I didn't know about you until preparing for this interview. You've done some voice acting.
A little bit, yeah.
How cool is that?
That is pretty cool, yeah. It's a lot of commercials. I don't know if I'd call it acting, but yeah, I've done some commercials and stuff like that.
No, that's voice acting.
Yeah, I guess
doing
it is.
Voiceover,
I guess it is.
Stuff, yeah. I tell people I'm a semi-pro voice actor because I have been paid to do the voice of voicemails.
If that's the criteria, then yes,
yeah,
I'm a former voice actor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If I ever get paid to do this stuff, then I guess I would
say
I'm not semi-pro anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would count. So, yeah, I mean, what kind of commercials?
Local commercials, mostly in Austin.
Okay.
I had the fortune of being in Austin as a theater student at the University of Texas, while my sister-in-law was a commercial producer at the NBC affiliate in Austin.
Okay.
And so she would call me up to do some commercials, and then if they needed like a British accent or something like that, I could come in and do some of those.
You could do a British accent?
Probably not as well as I could back then when I was doing a little bit more Shakespeare and other things.
Gotcha. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, I won't put you on the spot then.
Yeah.
I'll put you on the spot about something else.
Okay. That sounds good.
Tell me about your sports announcing.
So sports announcing, actually, my first job out of college was working at Rice University in the intramural sports department, and just made some connections with people in athletics. And that led to doing some courtside announcing. So public address work started with volleyball, then on to basketball. I've done public address for just about every sport at Rice. And I've also done it at like HBU. I've done it at U of H. I've done it for like the Southland Conference basketball tournament, which is usually in Houston every year. Haven't done it in the last 2 years, not since COVID started. But it's a fun way to stay around sports, which... You know, I love. I don't love the paycheck of working in college sports. That's one of the reasons I left that industry. But I love being around it, and that's kind of a fun way to keep my toe in the pool there.
Gotcha. And speaking of which, a common hobby of ours is scorekeeping at
baseball games.
Yes. When did you start that? And what do you feel makes it enjoyable?
You know,
it's hard to explain.
It is hard to explain.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just kind of makes, you know, watching the game a little bit more appealing. So I learned how to score keep because I was not a great baseball player. I wanted nothing more than to be a great baseball player, but I was not. And I think after kind of riding the pine a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
One of the assistant coaches was kind enough to say, "Hey, Paul, keep score. I'm going to teach you how to do it."
Hmm.
And, you know, from that, it led me to do it. And then I would start kind of doing it for games I'd watch on TV. I've actually score kept the All-Star game every year since like 87.
I was hoping you'd bring that up. That has got to be the most ridiculous scorecard.
I think Bob Costas has the same joke every single year. If you can score at home, stop.
Stop.
When they put in. What was cool is I did get to go to the All-Star game that they had in Houston. I think it was in 04.
Okay, yeah.
And it's so much easier to keep score because you can see people coming in. You can actually see the switches. You can see the lineup changes on the scoreboard. And I was like, oh, this is how you score the All-Star game.
Oh, I got you. As opposed to watching it on TV, you're able to... Yeah, because you're right. It does make it easier to do.
Yeah. And Tebow helps now. That you can pause.
Being able
write
to pause
them all down.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Because
we talked about how you do that now. But you say you've been doing it since 86?
Yeah.
So how in the world did you keep up with that?
You know, people played like 9 innings more often than,
know,
the stars played, 8 or 9 innings. You didn't have like the unwritten rule to get every middle infielder and relief pitcher from every team in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit easier. It got a little chaotic there in like the 90s. but yeah. Made it work.
Gotcha. Tell me about your time as a referee and an umpire.
Yeah, so I learned how to referee soccer when I was a kid, actually. You know, the soccer club that I played at in Florida was looking for referees all the time. And so I was up there all the time playing, and I figured I may as well get paid for it. So they let us, you know, referee some younger kids' games. And so learned how to do that. And so when I showed up on a college campus, was looking for part-time work, and went into the intramural sports department, said, hey, I want to referee soccer. They're like, soccer doesn't start for 2 months. How about football? Can you be there tonight? We'll teach you. And so just kind of went from that and, you know, learned how to do that and really enjoyed it. Baseball was my favorite sport to officiate. Loved umpiring baseball. Did a lot of Little League games in Austin. When we moved to Houston, I refereed football, you know, kind of got on a crew and did mostly JV and freshman football games. Did that for a couple of years and then just with kids and work, just couldn't keep up with it as much. But really enjoyed it.
Do you ever get any belligerent fans yelling at you?
Yes. Belligerent fans, belligerent parents, belligerent coaches. Yes. basketball mostly.
Really?
I think basketball is the one sport where every call is subjective.
Yeah,
depending
for sure.
on your angle, and you're pissing somebody off with every call or non-call.
Mm-hmm.
And so people get really heated in basketball. Football, oddly enough, I expected more of that, but I did mostly games in HISD, and it was great for the first couple weeks, and then grades came out, and teams were decimated. And so you'd have coaches okay. just tell you, just make the clock disappear. I got 14 guys to play both sides of the ball, just... Let's make this go quick. And so I was kind of surprised by that. Didn't expect that. But, you know, maybe that's me not being on a big-time varsity crew, which I just didn't stick around long enough to do.
Okay. Did you ever toss anybody out of a game?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
All the time?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, usually I have pretty thick skin. You know, I know I'm a bigger guy. I know I wear glasses. There's some easy targets right there. That's not going to hurt my feelings. you know, if I'm throwing a player out, it's usually because they... did something pretty violent.
Really?
You know, like a really hard tackle or, you know,
okay.
you know, bowling over the catcher in a game of slow pitch softball. So, I mean, they weren't surprised when I threw them out for things like that.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. You bring it up your glasses. I guess you did get to put your glasses on. Oh, you
yeah.
already got glasses. You need
yeah.
to get your eyes checked.
Every variation of that, yeah.
Do you think it's harder to make a safe out call or call balls and strike? I would imagine balls and strikes.
You know, I think it probably is safe out is probably a little bit harder because
really?
You know, if you only get so many of those bang bang calls in a game.
Mm-hmm.
If you're behind the plate, you know, you're seeing hundreds of pitches. And so I think you get to kind of establish and you kind of get to set the tone for your strike zone that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, usually you're pretty consistent. You can be consistently wrong, but, you know, from where you're standing right there, you know,
and
it's pretty easy to be consistent.
And that's what players normally say is that
yeah.
we just want you to be consistent. Which, so now with that background, how do you feel about the electronic strike zones and stuff like that? Do you think it's a good idea, bad idea? Do you think it adds or takes away from the game?
It's hard to say, and I guess they haven't done it at the major league level yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would kind of be more just like a buzz in the umpire's pocket or something like that to kind of help them determine.
Mm-hmm.
We
have umpires like Angel Hernandez that will, I've seen him call a ball on a pitch that was right down the middle, a meatball down
yeah.
the middle. And the reason why, to his defense, although when you're at that level of your career, you should not be making that terrible call.
Right.
But what I've noticed is that him in particular, he'll notice where the catcher sets up. And if
yeah.
the catcher moves a lot, then he knows the pitcher missed his spot and he calls it a ball, even if it's in the strike zone.
Right. And then you talk about that being the art of a good catcher. Is this how to frame the pitch?
Frame the pitch, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So, and that's my thought behind it a lot of times is that, man, it shouldn't be subjective like that. You
yeah.
We have clear, defined rules of where the strike zone is.
Yeah.
And for one umpire to have his zone, it doesn't sound like it fits the
rules. It doesn't.
But then again,
yeah,
that's the way baseball's always been. So yeah, that if we start putting technology in there, and that's why I'm on the fence with it.
Because, I'm on the fence. I'd have to see how it did. I mean, I think, you know, with instant replay in football, for example, mm-hmm, and then, you know, kind of being a football referee really before they implemented it on a wide scale basis in college and pros, I was like, let's see. But I think they found the right mix where, mm-hmm, you know, you can't be in like the perfect position to see every play, which is why, you know, safe out is kind of a tougher call, because, you know, you can be in the perfect position and then somebody's knee can block your angle. And so you just miss it and you're kind of picking it up from context clues. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit easier at first base because, you know, to kind of look for the foot hitting the bag and listening for the ball hitting the glove. You've got kind of a little bit more of an oral cue.
Okay.
About whether or not the ball got there before the foot. But if you're sliding into home or sliding into second, you better hope that you're not obstructed.
Yeah.
And so that's, but I think they did a good job with football as far as figuring out, okay, having six angles in HD, you know, right, you'll always do right better than a pair of human eyes that has to respond in a split second.
Off the rim.
You know, speaking of which, I watched the highlights from the 1980 Oilers-Steelers game.
Okay.
With that controversial call with, you know, the pass, and I can't remember the receiver's last name. His first name was Mike, but it was Pastorini threw the pass, and he catches it, and his feet are down, and they called it incomplete, and there's no instant replay.
Yeah.
Now, sorry, Oilers fans. I think the Oilers still would have lost that game. I really do.
Right.
It's that would have tied the game. Bradshaw was playing pretty well. So was Pastorini, but Earl Campbell could not get going. The Steelers
right
were all over him, and the Oilers did
those
not
those were some
win
good Steelers teams at that time.
Yeah, it really so was. But that call, that will infuriate any old school Houston
sure,
Oilers.
Sure, sure.
And, it was instant replay, I think, was a good one. And I also think that they did it right.
Yeah.
I didn't like at first how you were limited to certain amounts.
Right.
But then when they did, okay, you know, any scoring play is up for review, and anything in the two-minute warning is
right,
the coaches can't review that to try to slow the clock down.
They make sure they get it right.
They figured it out. Yeah, they figured it out, and I think that it worked out.
And as it turns
recent
out,
years, baseball's been doing it with now their stuff. I think each coach is only allowed two challenges.
I'm not sure the rule, because it doesn't come up as much unless it's blatant or, I mean, they'll review like the fair foul and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's fair foul, safe out. I think that's the only thing they can challenge.
Pretty
fair
much.
Foul,
I think maybe catch or trap. But again, that's kind
of right,
safe
well,
out
that's,
again, well,
that's safe out kind of thing. But you're right, though. That's okay, we're going off the rails on baseball, and that's okay. That's okay.
Zach and I can talk baseball for hours. So,
look, every ump has their own called strike three, and this is where I'm going to call you. I'm going to put you on the spot. All right. I want to hear yours, but first, I'm going to let me set it up, okay?
Yeah.
All right. And this will give you a chance to prepare. All right.
Yeah.
All right. So, it's the bottom of the ninth, 2022 World Series. All right. Game 7, and Justin Verlander's throwing a perfect game.
Oh,
all
yeah.
Right? Oh, man, this is amazing. You're behind the plate.
Yeah.
Right? You got the advance, and you're the one behind the plate. You're calling the game. It's a dream come true, right? Right? Two outs. Astros are leading just 1-0. It is an epic pitcher's duel.
Yeah.
All right? Full count. Justin Verlander paints the corner black.
Strike three!
And the crowd goes wild.
And the crowd goes wild. See, if this was on YouTube, because it really is about
it's
the punch.
It's the.
Yeah, I mean, nobody can hear you.
Right.
The catcher and the batter can hear that.
That's what I normally
hear. Yeah, maybe someone sitting in the front row, but it's all about the how long you hold, you throw your arm out there, how long you hold it back before you punch the other one.
Uh-huh.
It's
well, some umpires will like completely spin around and go,
you get like Frank Drebin and Naked Gun.
Yeah.
not quite that demonstrative, but yeah, I think it's fun. Everyone gets their own special one. Yeah.
All right. So you started as a financial advisor in 2004.
Yes.
All right. By the way, that was the same year as that the Astros signed Roger Clemens.
Yes.
And they traded for Carlos Beltran.
Mm-hmm.
You're a Yankee fan. I know this. So yes. This was also the year that the Red Sox came back and the Yankees down 3 games in the ALCS. Yep. What a year, huh? What a year.
Well, you know, I am a Yankees. I mean, lifelong Yankees fan, but I've lived in Houston for 25 years. I mean, probably more than that at this point. And so I am an Astros fan as well. It was easier when they were in separate leagues.
Yeah.
And that was the year where it was about to get real because the Yankees were up 3-2 at one point on the Red Sox before they blew it.
Mm-hmm. 3-0.
3-0.
They were up 3-0.
The Astros were up 3-2 on the Cardinals.
Right.
So both of them were one win away from the World Series. And here I was wondering, who would I root for? Yeah. In that scenario. And both of them blow a 3-2 lead. And we had the Red Sox-Cardinals World Series. Of course, the Astros came back the next year. And you know, you lose a series about as close as you can when it's a sweep. But, I mean, all four of those games were one-run games.
That was such a crazy season, too, because I can't tell you how many pitchers' duels we saw.
Right.
Like 1-0 games. It's like the Astros could not bat their way out of a wet paper bag. They had Roger Clemens pitching with a 1.82 mm-hmm. ERA that season.
Yeah.
And he had 13 wins.
Yeah.
All right. But you started as a financial advisor in 2004. Tell mm-hmm. us about that journey. Let's stop talking baseball and tell
Absolutely.
Us about that
Absolutely. So at the time, I was actually working in another profession. I was working as kind of a really kind of an administrative work. Was working at Rice. I just moved over to the Med Center and started working at MD Anderson. And my wife and I found out that we were expecting our daughter.
Okay.
And, she told me, hey, I want to stay home. At the time, she was making more than me. That really kind of broadened my search into, okay, what else could I do? What could I do that I could earn more money? Yeah, pressure's on.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go back to school. Didn't have enough time to do that. And so I knew I was good with math. I knew I was good with numbers. And so I figured, hey, you know what? Maybe I'll take some classes at community college, become a CPA or something like that. Kind of build up to that.
So you majored in theater. And so that's what I was going to ask is how the heck did you end up with your career? But you're telling us.
Yeah. So went from the theater degree, which, I is what I love doing at 18. And so I think that's the danger mm-hmm. of letting kids pick their college majors at 18,
Agreed.
Right? Reached a point where I knew I didn't want bad enough to pursue a degree in theater or pursue a career in theater. I didn't want to go move to New York, starve, wait tables just for a break. Mm-hmm. I wanted a family. I wanted a normal life. And so, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I didn't know what else to do. I figured I'd put my head down and just finish my degree. And it was cheap enough to do that in the late 90s when college tuition was $1,200 a semester. You could just kind of figure it out in a major that doesn't pay anything and
right.
not waste money. We've got a daughter who's a junior in high school, and we're looking at colleges. So I know you can't make that same decision now when it's $20,000 a year. But anyway, I digress.
It's part of your financial advisor role.
It is
that kind of stuff because you're spending a lot of money with that.
Yeah.
But let me ask your opinion about that because I've got a 21-year-old, I've got a 19-year-old. Neither one of them have started going to college. Well, that's not true. My 19-year-old has taken a couple of classes. But neither one of them's declared a major or really done much. And I personally think that's a great choice.
Right.
Because that's so young to be making such major decisions that's going to affect the rest of your life. You brought up the financial side of it.
Yeah.
Your kid's going to be $100,000 in debt before they get a degree in something that they might not even have a career in.
Absolutely. Studies have shown, people, especially our generation, they change careers, not just jobs, but change careers.
Yeah.
At least twice. I look at myself. That fits for me. I went from sports administration to, kind of administrative work to being a financial advisor. So, that tracks. So what would I tell somebody? Unless you absolutely know what you're going to do and have an opportunity to go to the best school mm-hmm. for that thing, I don't know why you would go hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt for that. I think it'd be better to get an affordable education, patch it together with, kind of state school, with community college in the summers, take an AP classes in high school, get as many credits as you can at cheaper rates mm-hmm. rather than at big university rates. Because if you really want to get prepared for something, you're probably going to have to get a master's degree. Or you're going to have to go through certification processes, which is outside of school anyway. So, you just kind of do what you can to keep undergrad affordable. And then by that point, you probably have a little bit more knowledge about what to do. And it becomes smarter money that you're spending.
Now, as a financial advisor, a lot of the investments that people will make has a designation of a Coverdale or that's what I have. The common term that people use is something else. What is it?
ESA, because it's a Coverdale ESA. So
okay.
You pick the first half and pick the second half. You're both right.
Well, it's... When I hear other people talk about it, they're calling it something else.
So there's a 529 plan. I think
the 529 plan. That's right. So either one of those, it's an education designation. Mm-hmm. And now you brought up trade school, and I remember you telling me, and I was shocked by this. It's not just trade school, but I mean, any kind of education expense can be covered by those funds.
As long as it's an accredited institution.
Okay.
So, I mean, if there's a new online university that pops up tomorrow, I've got to wait and kind of see if they're actually legit. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty much what I tell people, everything but beer, pizza, and a ticket home.
Right.
I mean, if it's a textbook, if it's, you know, it can get a little hazy with it with kind of a dorm because, you know, dorm meal plan. But
gotcha.
I think if you're going full time, it covers those. Yeah.
Well, and you want to be conservative what you're using it for. Yeah. The point that I was making is that when you're 18, 19 years old, even early 20s and whatnot, first off, our bodies are in better shape at that age.
Yeah.
You know, I'm learning that as you know, most of the
people. As things start to hurt in your 40s, yeah.
Right, yeah. And so we can get certifications in physical labor and do that while we're young and then start to get a feel for what it is that we want to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I've told my kids, is to look into that. I know electricians that are making six figures.
Oh, yeah.
I know plumbers that are making six figures. The problem with that is that as those people are turning 40, 50 years old, your body can't take that kind of grind anymore. So do it while you're young instead of... this has been my advice. Like you said, unless you know what you want to do and you've had the opportunity to go to a great institution and whatnot, you know, obviously you don't want to miss that opportunity. But man, give it some time and do something to where, you know, you could definitely not only take care of yourself, but take care of a family with a lot of these trades.
Well, I think also, I mean, I'm not going to tell anybody don't go to college or
but I'm just saying you don't to go.
You don't, and be mindful of why you're going to college. You're going there just because you're good at school and it's the next step, or because you don't have a choice and you think, well, if I'm undecided, I'll go to school.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely feel like having a bachelor's degree opened doors for me from early careers.
Sure. Yeah. No, and I've seen that too, to where it closes doors for some people if you don't have
work experience, especially as an entrepreneur, work experience is by far more valuable. Mm-hmm. I'm a financial advisor with a bachelor's in theater and dance. I think I've looked at studies that show, and that is the like most worthless degree in terms of return on your investment and what you can expect to be earning. But yeah, I think I've made the best of it because, you know, for me, although there's no, you know, obvious application of theater to finance, I'm comfortable talking to people. Mm-hmm. I'm comfortable talking in front of a group. And I know that those are some terrifying scenarios for a lot of professionals. And so being able to think on my feet, talk in front of, and feel confident and feel comfortable talking in front of a group is a very valuable skill.
No, that's a very valid point, actually. So it's not a worthless degree. Because
it's not.
That is the main obstacle that not just entrepreneurs, but anybody faces.
Sure.
Is being able to speak publicly. I took a public speaking class a very long time ago.
Yeah.
And that was something that I was actually shocked about, is that the like top five fears that people have, number one is public speaking.
Right.
And I think number two was death.
I think I've heard that. People would be more scared to be given the eulogy than to be the one in the box getting the eulogy
about
them.
Exactly, yeah. It's terrifying to people. And
right.
What's also really cool, networking as me and you do, is that to see somebody come in and struggle with that and then watch them blossom.
Absolutely. You
know, because we've all been there.
Yeah.
We all get the sweaty palms. We all start to...
Sure.
It's even doing this one-on-one, because I know that other people are going to be listening to it, I catch myself stuttering a little bit. I catch myself given a lot of ums, and I, as a matter of fact, I'll probably edit out 15 minutes of these episodes of just ums and you knows.
Well, I think it's also like, I mean, even if you're the smoothest, most polished public speaker, I mean, especially if you're an entrepreneur, I mean, you go through years of having imposter syndrome and really kind of feeling like, hey, yeah, I know a little bit about what I'm talking about, but not as much as somebody who's been in this industry for 10, 20 years. Are people going to know? Are people going to pick up on the fact that, hey, I'm still early in my career? And all the insecurities that kind of come with that. So I think you kind of have to develop the confidence in yourself and in your ability to do your business and communicate your value. That comes first. And then hopefully kind of the public speaking and communicating to a wider group about, hey, this is what I do. This is why you should use me. Yeah. You know, can come after that. But they often go hand in hand.
No, for sure. You brought up imposter syndrome. I was a guest on someone else's podcast a little over a year ago, and that came up.
Right.
Because it, and this was a different subject, because she's bringing up all these awesome things about me. I'm like, whatever. And,
right.
And she's like, you know, stop being modest. And this is even beyond modest. This is imposter syndrome. I'm like, sure. Oh, yeah, I'm not going to deny that for a second. I've improvised my way through most of my life.
Well, you reach a point professionally. Yeah, like I've been doing this, you know, 17, 18 years, and I know a lot. But boy, I sure thought I knew a lot like 4 years in, and I knew so little, I think, compared to what I know now. So it kind of makes me, you know, I'm mindful of that, where it's like, am I going to look back 20 years from now and be like, man, I didn't know anything back in 2022.
I hope so.
Right.
I hope so.
Yeah, because that means we're growing at least.
Exactly. Yeah. No, and that was something that, again, I heard this not too long ago. This was a book that I read that I can't read the title of because it's profane.
I think most who are into self-improvement or networking probably know the book that you're talking about.
It's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Bleep.
Yes.
And it's actually the second book, the sequel to that. It's called Everything is Effed.
Right.
And that one was, I don't want to say it's as good as the first one, but it had some really, really good nuggets in it also. And one of them was that I hope that 15, 20 years from now, I can look back at my life today and to clean it up a little bit.
Yeah.
To feel like I didn't really know that much.
Sure.
Because if I look back on my life 10, 15 years ago and think that how smart I was, that why couldn't I be like that today? We had that negative outlook on everything. So if we could put it in a positive way, if I could look back at myself 10, 15 years ago and think of how little bit I knew, that means that I've learned an awful lot these next, last 10, 15 years.
That's a very mature attitude to have. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it takes some awareness to
mature.
To get to that point.
But when you lazy with profanity, it makes it cool.
Oh, right? Yeah. Gotta keep it cool. Yeah.
So why should someone invest with you? What makes you stand out? I know what makes you stand out, but I want to hear it from you.
So other than the amazing voice and the baseball knowledge that I can spin out at any time.
That's why I'm attracted to you. Sorry for your wife. But
no, that's fine. That's fine. That's the value add for Zach is all right, some financial advice and then a lot of baseball talk. Yeah.
No, but seriously, what makes you stand out?
You know, I think for me, it's the problem solving.
Okay.
Is I think trying to find out, really getting to the root of what people are trying to do. And that's really what gets the bottom of financial advising, because, you know, you can find software programs that can help you invest. If that's all you're looking for, you can do that. But really what we're looking for is trying to get to the root of what is it you're trying to accomplish? What are some of the barriers or some of the challenges you're encountering? What are some things you have in your favor? Maybe it's a high income. Maybe it's, you know, kind of a flexible, tax situation, whether you're self-employed or something like that. And then, you know, what are you afraid of? You know, and so what kind of behavioral issues do we need to adjust for? Because that's really kind of what gets to the root of how people stick to a plan or not. Are they disciplined? Are they anxious? Are they kind of micromanaging? And none of that's wrong. It just means we have to kind of adjust and making sure that those are all in line with your expectations. And then really what I try to do is I try to engage people in a way to where they're participating as well. I like to touch base with people every 6 months. I like to sit down with them every 12 and make sure we review things. And it's not just, hey, here's what's going on. It's how does that... how does that work out with what we set up? Is what we set up still what you want, or have things changed? Because I think the people that have the most success are the people that take a little bit of ownership over the advice that I give them, and kind of keep up with it and give me feedback about, hey, you know what, we thought we wanted this, but what would happen if we looked at this instead? Whether it's retiring a little bit sooner, whether it's, you know, buying an RV and selling the house and things like that, and just kind of going across the country to see the grandkids, you know. So it, mm-hmm. I think having that feedback is very valuable to me and helps me give better advice. So I don't know if that's kind of a roundabout way to answer your question as far as kind of what sets me apart. But
One of the things that I really enjoyed about you is the fact that you listen to me.
Yeah.
And then when my son, who's 21 now, I think he was only 18 at the time.
Right.
I don't even remember what the conversation was, but he had expressed an interest in trying to get some investments and whatnot. I'm like, well, let's sit down and talk to Paul.
Sure.
And you listened. And you came up with a different plan with him than he did with me. Because
right.
he was 18 years old and I wasn't.
Sure.
and he had some different ideas of what he wanted to do with it than I did. And I like that. I like that you didn't sit down and tell us what we needed to focus on.
Yeah.
You listened to what we were already focused on and then made the plan based off of that.
Well, thank you. And I think I always, you know, tell people, I'll explain as little or as much as you want me to explain.
And that's why you're good at this and I'm not.
Yeah.
I over-explain because I'm fascinated by it. And as I'm sure you are as well. And so for me, it would be hard for me to sit down and go over it. I'd get so lost in the details and people would be like, yeah, I'm going to go talk to Paul.
So I guess that's where the communication comes in from the theater degree.
Well, you know, it's a very good point. See, it's not worthless.
It is worthless. So, I mean, we live in an area with a lot of engineers. And so I do have a lot of engineer clients.
Yes.
They want to know everything about everything. So you talk about me getting excited about things. I get exhausted, I think, at certain points. So I'll explain as much. I'll research just to answer your question.
Yeah.
But then there's some other ones who are like, just shut up already and tell me where to sign. And you don't want to abuse that. But at the same time, you know, you want to be sensitive to, you create anxiety by over-explaining.
Yeah. And that's... I do that with my clients, and I try not to, but I get lost in the details.
Sure.
But at the same time, and it's weird, I'm kind of the opposite with my investments.
Right.
It's because, really, if I'm going to get involved with something, I'm either all in or I'm all out.
Right.
And investments is one of those things that it's not very interesting to me.
Right.
It's not something that I would see myself really... it's too volatile. But I needed to do it. So what should I do about that?
Yeah.
And that was where, so, you know, I sat down with you and I probably rambled on for 30 minutes while you listened to me and we came up with a plan. And after that, it's almost like a slow cooker, man. I sit it and forget it.
I think the best investments are the boring ones.
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
yeah.
Especially if you're thinking long term. You know, it's you buy good quality stocks that pay dividends, or you buy a good quality mutual fund that's managed well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would be a lot more exciting if we had a hot tip that nobody else had and could buy the stock at 5 cents and watch it ride up to $100. Yeah. That would be exciting.
Yeah.
And that would be the thing where, you know, yeah, we had that lottery ticket approach, so to speak. We can get more engaged in that. It's tougher to get more engaged in just a growth mutual fund. But there's a reason why it works. Especially, you know, if you do it right the first time, you don't have to keep messing with it.
I think it's my baseball card collection is what kept me away from having that approach with stock.
Off the rail.
That was my original...
That 89 Upper Deck Griffey rookie card was supposed to be worth a lot more now.
Yeah, and all of my Shaquille O'Neal rookie cards that I had back when I liked basketball.
Oh,
I still have probably 6 or 7 Shaq rookie cards.
You know what
they
was
made so
crazy?
Many.
They did. They
that's
flooded
what, that's
the
what
market.
Happened.
They flooded the market.
They made so many because they knew that kids our age were going crazy about it. We saw the Nolan Ryan rookie card that you used to get in the literally a pack of bubble gum.
Yeah.
Worth over $1,000.
Yeah.
And so we were throwing down in the... Yeah.
And what's crazy now, I don't know how closely you follow it. I haven't bought any new sports cards in 10 years, but it's like they flooded the market,
right?
Brought down the value, and then they contracted. And now things are like super rare to where they'll only make a certain number of those. Like Mike Trout's
rookie. They do it on purpose.
Yeah, maybe. Mike Trout's rookie card, just from the basic top set, it's like $1,500.
screw Mike Trout.
Ah, I know. But so now everything's going for crazy money, and I'm like, God, did I quit too soon?
Yeah. The old investor thing. Pulled out too soon.
Exactly. Yes.
So stocks. The reason why I'm talking about this is it's kind of comparing it to that. Is you're trying to go and you're trying to get that hot one. You're trying to get the one that you buy at a nickel and now it's worth so much more and whatnot.
People are using sports cars as alternative investments now. I mean, they're going to auction. They're buying like a Giannis rookie card with his jersey and it's autographed and there's only like five of them. I mean, they'll buy it at auction for $500,000 and then sell it 3 years later for 1.5. I mean, it would happen with you think Giannis had one, I think Patrick Mahomes had one like that.
Really?
I think Brady had one. There was, and then there was another Trout. These very short print cards with either an autograph or a piece of their jersey, or both, that came out their rookie year. Yeah, and they'll get them professionally graded and they'll sell them. And then investors will buy it and sit on it for 3 years and then turn around and sell it for more. So it's almost becoming a legitimate alternative investment. To me, highly speculative.
Well, so that's what I was comparing it to, like penny stocks and whatnot.
Sure.
Where it's like you might make it big, and more than likely you're not, though.
Right.
Is that a fair comparison?
I think it's a fair comparison. But it's interesting. I think you and I both kind of got into investing
through the packs of baseball cards.
Yeah. That's a great entry level drug there.
So, all right, and this is a great segue here, the entry-level drug. What about marijuana stocks?
Yeah. No, well, what do I think about that? It's funny. I think the questions I get the most are marijuana stocks and
crypto.
Bitcoin. Crypto. Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about, and I actually asked this question to one of our fund managers, and he said, if you think about it, a stock is a company that has gotten large enough and is managed well enough to go public and sell ownership shares, the company, to the public. And so that's what a stock is. And then you hold that stock and hopefully it grows or earns dividends. A marijuana company is more likely to position themselves to be sold to a big tobacco company.
Yeah. Okay.
Somebody that has the large scale production capabilities. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of companies, and it could be a great business model. I just don't think we're going to see a lot of those companies come to market as stocks. So if you're really interested in that or feel like that is a good solid investment because it'll be utilized in the future, maybe you want to invest in the companies that would buy companies like that more so than the small companies themselves.
And now this is where my ignorance may end up showing.
Okay? Yeah.
But wouldn't a big tobacco company buying a small marijuana company be a positive for the investors? Because now you're not invested in a small marijuana company. Now you're invested in, a big tobacco company.
You are. So, yeah.
I think despite the stain that big tobacco has, pun intended.
Sure, right.
Wouldn't that be a good thing?
You'd think that. I think it's just a matter of there's not that many it's more the issue with the startup. Than with this particular type of industry,
it's just the volatility.
The volatility, right? But also which one of them, make it. Which one of them even come to market as a stock? I mean, you could say that, but if it's just a bunch of small companies out there, they're never going to be big enough to issue a stock. So, I mean, how do you invest in them other than start one up yourself?
Gotcha.
Or loan your buddy some money to start his, and that's an even worse investment.
Gotcha. So, what do you think is one of the more common mistakes investors make, and what advice would you give to counter that mistake?
I think the investments that you pick don't matter nearly as much as when you start investing and the consistency with which you invest. There's no magic bullet out there that will make up for a lack of contributions. There's no one stock where you can put in $100 and then it's worth $1 million.
Yeah, okay.
Discipline. Investing early, investing often, that's how you win the game. So as you're saying, in our industry, the best time to invest was probably 30 years ago. The second best time is today.
Yeah.
So really that is probably the most universal advice I can give is don't worry so much. Don't spend so much time. Don't paralyze yourself with research and wait to invest until you find the perfect thing to invest in. Start putting money away. That is the most important thing because that's going to reflect, the quality of your retirement or your kids' college savings or whatever goal you're saving for it's going to be measured by how much you put in, more so than the return you're getting on your money. Because, you know, if we pick a great fund that's got a 20% return, well, hey, 20% of $1 million is $200,000. Mm-hmm. 20% of $50,
right?
That's a couple bucks. You know, so I think the people who win the game are the people who have invested more over time, stayed in long enough to get the good returns on a big balance, mm-hmm. rather than the good returns on the thing they put a couple bucks a month in and then stopped.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. All right, lastly and most importantly, who do you pick to win the 2022 World Series?
Okay.
If there's nothing else that anyone takes away from this episode, what one thing would you like listeners to remember? And then we'll talk World Series.
Talk World Series. Right. So from an entrepreneurial standpoint, you know, get out and meet people. You know, every new entrepreneur, new entrepreneur is probably coming from a scarcity mentality to where they feel like, okay, I have to get as much business right now because it's going to dry up. And so, therefore, everyone they talk to is a potential client. And any encounter that doesn't end in business is a failure. And that's just kind of what's going through any kind of rookie entrepreneur's mind.
Maybe because I was raised as an entrepreneur, that was never my approach in the beginning. That's really interesting that you say, because you're right, young entrepreneurs, and when I say young, I mean new to entrepreneur.
Right. Because it's scary to step off that ledge of that kind of, you know, every 2 weeks, I know I get this, I know I've got health benefits. So when you're in that survival mentality, you almost have this, kind of hunter-gatherer mentality. It's like, hey. if I don't catch something, I starve.
Right, and we've talked about that for sure. It's the more relaxed that we are, really, the better the closing rate goes with sales. It's almost like people can smell the desperation.
They can, yeah. So if you don't need it, then you almost have more success.
What I've told people, and this is the way that I started, it's still the way that I run my business today, is that 90% of business is building and maintaining relationships. And I've said this, you know, before, and I'll say it again. It's I could care less about the $100 service call and going and fixing somebody's phone jack. As a matter of fact, if I don't have to see another phone jack the rest of my life, I will die happy.
Sure.
It's not about the phone jack. It's not about the $100. It's about building a relationship with that client and being loyal to them and taking care of them and doing what's right, so that when the time comes that they need service and whatnot, they're going to remember, you know, who took care of them.
Absolutely. And
so you're turning that around and you're saying, get in front of people, even if it's just hand them a business card. Not that business cards are nearly as big as they used to be.
Sure.
But get in front of people, get your name out there and whatnot. What may end up being, feels like absolutely nothing today, 5 years down the road could lead to an amazing opportunity.
Absolutely. Because you have to realize, I think, you know, when you're networking, when you're meeting other entrepreneurs, what's more valuable than their business is their continued referrals. And that's really only going to happen if there's a level of trust. And so get to know everybody. Get to find out what they do. Get to understand them. Get to know them as people. Because having a support system...
Ooh, Zyrens, they're out to get me.
Yeah. Right. We're across the street from a little ER, so...
I like it. No,
there's probably somebody dying, Zach.
Oh, no.
Or maybe not. That's why they go to the hospital. Good people.
Yeah.
Taking care of them.
Those saving Zyrens lives. Because they're saving
someone. Saving lives. Somebody's about to be saved, right?
Yes.
We hope.
So your advice, in a nutshell, is networking.
It is.
And that was something that I wasn't taught.
Yeah.
As you know, fourth-generation entrepreneur... My family had a business that they had already kind of built that it was maintaining itself. And so networking was something that I had to learn.
Yeah.
And so that's your main advice, it sounds
Absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely.
Out there and network.
And it's going to take a lot of different forms. You know, if you can join a group where you can kind of be around the same group of people, build that know, like, and trust, that's so valuable. If you can join a couple of chambers where you can just meet a whole bunch of people, every time you go to an event, there's new people there that you can meet, that's great. You know, find out who's going to be a good referral partner for you. Who's in an adjacent business where you're in front of the same types of people talking about the same types of things. Mm-hmm. Like for me, it's a tax pro, a mortgage person, someone does health insurance, things like that.
Okay.
we're talking to the same people about the same types of things, but where they stop, I start, and vice versa.
Yeah.
Talk to people in your industry, even if they're at competing firms.
Some of the best business partners are competitors.
Absolutely, yeah. Because at least they know exactly what you're going through. They're going to notice trends in the area, and it's not as competitive as you might think. I think because they're probably going to be here to be able to talk shop with somebody or to be able to kind of let down with somebody as well. Exactly. And that's kind of where you go back to the scarcity mentality is if you believe that there's only so much to go around, you'll struggle as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You really will. If you believe and know in your heart that there's enough business for everybody, you'll have a much more positive outlook. You'll have much more positive results. It just kind of works that way.
Yeah.
And I think you'll still be competitive, but you won't be competitive to a fault to where you feel like somebody else has to lose for you to win.
Right. You never want to play the us versus them mentality.
No, exactly.
It just doesn't work.
You'll never hear me bad-mouthing another advisor or another firm. Once we turn this off,
All right, 2022 World Series. Now, I know this is difficult because of the lockout right now.
Right.
All right. But let's say free agents that aren't signed right now don't sign anywhere. So bye-bye Carlos Correa.
So the teams are set
right now. Who are you picking and why?
Okay. I really don't want this to be the case because I think it's just so boring. But the Tampa Bay Rays are going to get over one of these days. I don't know how they manage.
Why is it boring? Because they're pitching?
I think because they're pitching, maybe because they don't have any stars, maybe because they figured out how to play and manage smart baseball, but it seems like it's the team that nobody wants to play or the team that everyone underestimates that they always end up kind of going a lot farther. I am primarily a Yankees fan, so I watch a lot of American League East baseball, and I still don't think I could tell you more than three people who are on the Rays. And they may all change because their analytics are so good and the way they do it.
They're very much like the Patriots of the Brady era, to like where just, they had that one person that's always there.
Yeah.
And everybody else was a revolving door, but they stayed good.
They're efficient. I picked them to go to the World Series this year. I'm glad the Astros got past them.
We dodged them.
Yeah, we dodged them, yeah.
I was scared of the Rays.
Yeah.
As an Astros fan. Wasn't scared of the Yankees.
Right. Because, the Yankees are the free Sox. Swingers. Yeah, Red Sox, you can beat them. The Rays, you never know. You go either way with them.
Yeah. I'm going to say something very unpopular in Houston.
Okay.
I don't think the Astros should sign Carlos Correa.
Right.
I think that he's asking for way too much. Mm-hmm. And I think that he turned on his all-star potential in a contract year miraculously.
Right.
And my experience with players that do that has not been good. 5 years from now, I may eat those words.
Sure.
But I think that the Astros should move Bregman over to short.
Mm-hmm.
And that would open up the opportunity to get a first baseman or a third baseman because Yuli's natural position is third base.
Okay.
And I think that the Astros should do that and maybe bring up one of the younger farm players to do either first or third, probably third.
Yeah.
And but you think about that, letting go of Carlos Correa gives them the opportunity to get a shortstop, a third baseman, or a first baseman.
That's a great point.
I think that they should invest in pitching. I think we figured out that's like, we had great pitching, but a couple of them, a couple of the younger guys ended up the stage got too big for them.
Right.
With Framber and Garcia, which I love both of those guys.
You look at how far we got with Cole and Verlander.
That was just it.
And if we hadn't run into Strasburg and Scherzer, then Verlander and Cole would have been enough, except for
Scherzer.
That's actually a pretty good thing. If it was 3 years, I would say absolutely sign him. But if it's like,
he wants
7 to 10
years, $300 million. That's what he wants. No,
that's,
man.
You're going to regret the second half of that.
Well, look at Albert Pujols. That's what happened with him. He still played out of his mind. Now, he was the exception. He still played out of his mind, but he didn't play $300 million.
Not in Los Angeles, he didn't.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. He didn't play $300 million. He wasn't St. Louis.
Two good years, And maybe you get some milestone home runs, but that's about it.
So with all of that said, that's the reason why I think the Astros still have just as good a chance now and in the future, you know, that they did in previous years, if they make that decision. I think if they sign Carlos Correa, it's going to handcuff them, keep them from being able to get good pitchers in, and I think they have less of a chance of another World Series if
they
sign
Correa. That's
a hot take. It is a hot take. It is a hot take.
You heard it here, right?
But that's what I think.
I think a lot of Astros fans are resigned to him going elsewhere anyway.
Yeah, they want him, though. Everybody's like, oh, pay the man, pay the man. Mm-mm. Don't pay the man. Don't pay him.
Yeah.
let the Yankees take that burden.
Oh, the Yankees aren't going to touch him.
That's the only ones left.
Yeah.
It's the Yankees, or he's going to have to not take that money.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to have to settle for less somewhere else.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think if the Astros sign him, it needs to be for a lot less money. Otherwise, I feel like they actually have less of a chance of winning the World Series with Correa than they would without.
And your season tickets will just have to go up in price to help pay Carlos Correa.
Yeah, exactly. And as a season ticket holder, I don't want that. All right, so I'm picking the Astros.
Okay.
And you're picking the Rays?
I'm picking the Rays. That's my smart money pick, but yeah, I hope I'm wrong.
You hope you're wrong.
You know, I you know, we kind of joke about being a Yankees fan, but I mean, I do love the Astros, and I was so.
Well, last few years, now you've got a New York Yankee Cup here, but yes, I do remember last few years when the Yankees and Astros faced each other, you were wearing orange.
I was. There is something magical about being in a city when they're winning.
Yeah,
and
agreed.
And it makes Houston better. It makes every interaction with everyone better.
And these Astros have turned Houston into a baseball town.
They really have.
Yeah.
They really have. And unfortunately, with the 2017, I mean, there is a stain over that, and they get a lot of people's minds. You know, I still think they would have won without it. I still don't think it made a huge difference in the World Series.
They're the ones who got caught.
They're the ones who
and
got
I'm
caught.
I'm not
right.
excusing it, but it's with that said, the Braves, okay, they just won the World Series. Yeah, that hurt. Sorry.
So that's all right. That's
but
all right.
It was just a few years ago that they got caught in a major scandal. It was
they
something. It was signing
so
free agents when they
weren't
the supposed to.
Maybe it was the most egregious. Maybe it was the most ambitious and the most just blatant. I don't know. But you know, I think the timing of when that all came out.
Yeah.
Coming out within a month of us losing a heart-wrenching World Series to the Nationals.
Right.
It was like we lost the World Series twice.
Oh yeah.
So more than anything, you know, Yankees. I want to see the Astros win a little.
Because Yankees never cheated.
Everyone's eye. Of course, the Yankees cheated.
It was just a few years ago when it was before the Rangers made the World Series, but they got caught stealing signs.
Sure. Stealing signs has been around for hundreds
forever.
Of years. Just maybe not with
they had a light
the level
in their outfield that they were flashing.
Yeah.
And it's not. Yeah, okay, they cheated, and it sucks.
Yeah.
And I do not like cheaters.
And if it keeps Altuve out of the Hall of Fame, or if it keeps, I'd like to
say that it won't, but they haven't put Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds in the Hall of Fame for the steroids.
Right.
And they weren't the only ones juicing.
They have one more chance.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks, we'll find out.
I know somebody who's a Hall of Fame voter. That I'm going to have him on this podcast pretty soon. Yeah,
great,
but
he
has voted. If I'm not mistaken, he has voted for Clemens and Bonds every year.
I would have.
I think I would have too.
Yeah.
What gets me about the we're out of time.
We're out of time.
Let's have another baseball podcast
part two.
Sometime. All right.
Yes.
Paul, thank you
no
so much.
No pretenses of business and just talk baseball. Yes. Zach, it's
so
a pleasure.
Much. Yeah. Man,
anytime.
It's
man.
A lot of fun.
Hope I left you enough to. After you edit, to still have some worthy content.
Oh, no. It's we're going to have an hour's worth of content because it's
great.
Baseball, man. It's all good.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Thanks
awesome.
For getting plugged in.
Hey, my pleasure.
And thank you for listening, making us a part of your day, and taking part in my story by being an Entree listener. To find out more information regarding today's guest, check out the show notes in your app or online at zachstafford.com. If you're wondering how I get such cool guests, well, networking. Reach out to me, and I'll send some resources your way. If you're in the Houston Bay Area, you can even be my guest at some events that have done more to grow my business than anything else. All of my contact information can be found in the show notes. The music for Entree Podcasting is performed, mixed, and engineered by the Deacon, Marcus Goad. The main artwork for Entree Podcasting was done by the Big Daddy Jim Sweeney and his team at Minuteman Press Bay Area. Thank you once again for listening. Until next time, I hope you stay plugged in and on the line.